fun podcast for you today. We'll do our NBA playoff power rankings, some observations from last night, a little carryover from the weekend as well. But we have Anthony Slater on the Warriors up 2-0 on the Denver Nuggets, and what is a real expectation for a team that's looked terrific in the first two. But this is going to be fun too. Mac McClung, the rookie of the year in the G League, South Bay Laker neighbor, his journey, high school dunking sensation on Instagram, to somebody trying to find a way to make it in the NBA. That'll be a lot of fun and life advice at the end. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. We have a new edition of the Playoff Power Rankings. Here's a little PSA. These are just power rankings that I use to make up, to use as a vehicle to get into talking about different NBA topics and assorted other stuff. The rankings aren't actually real, so if you're upset that you feel like something is lower than it should be or higher than it should be, probably go outside a little bit more. Steph and the Warriors take the top spot. This is really impressive two games in, and we'll get to why Denver actually is just a brutal matchup for Denver, this Golden State team, better said that way. But as I said, we had this mysterious open where after the Warriors get it rolling, Draymond's coming back, Klay's looking a bit more like himself. I'm like, man, I might be all the way back in on this team, even though I'm a little worried about the front court depth, especially in a matchup against a guy like DeAndre Ayton. Now, there's still a lot of work that has to go on to even have that dream scenario in the Western Conference Finals. But what this new lineup of death is doing, and it's Jordan Poole, it's Wiggins, it's Green, it's Steph, and it's Klay, and it's Steph coming off the bench, which I really hope there's someone out there that will give us the television headline, are the Warriors better with Steph off of the bench? Look, they're just, everybody's better with Steph, but this is ridiculous. We're going to have Anthony Slater on a little bit later in the podcast from The Athletic, and there's a number, and it's very small, we're two games into this, but there's a number where this group and what they're doing offensively is like 200 points per 100 possessions, and they're allowing like 75. So it's absurd. It's so absurd. It's kind of fake, but it's also real. It's real for two games. But my feeling was if all of these players were together and the plan was to just guard to death, not meaning defensively, but to basically throw four guards out there, even though Wiggins is kind of like a small forward, he's had moments where he's played, you know, in the backcourt. Have these four dudes out there together with Draymond, who couldn't be more fired up to defend Jokic, the MVP. And it's an awful matchup for Denver, but it's a little reminder of what Golden State can look like when it's horrifying. I don't know if this number is right from last night, because I was looking for it this morning and trying to figure out, because it's so ridiculous. But in 19 game minutes, the Warriors scored 70 points. Is that possible? Is it possible that that was real? Or because it was from somebody who like covers it from a stats thing. It wasn't like a joke, but that's what it is. I mean, it wasn't a great start for game two. You're like, all right, is Denver motivating? It's just Denver's not very good. All right, so that takes us to number two in the power rankings. Jokic, find the missing ballots topic. This isn't quite like a presidential election debate here, whether or not the election was stolen. But the Jokic has two bad games. Denver's down 0-2. the reassessment of Jokic as the MVP, like this is the most predictable thing that we do in sports. And we do it with the Heisman. You know, I don't know. Like I've had issues with arguments where I'll hear like somebody's good as an NFL player. And then we think back, like, can you believe he didn't win the Heisman? Like, wait, so we're at week 8 of his rookie year in the NFL. And now we're supposed to feel bad about who won the Heisman in a completely different fucking sport the previous season. This is not as extreme, but this is kind of the point. If you're an Embiid or a Giannis guy, you're like, oh, this guy's the MVP. I think that was kind of a point of one of the many points of why Jokic won the MVP or will win the MVP. Or again, I voted for him because you're like, this team just isn't that good. But Jokic hasn't been very good. He's minus 45 through 2 in all the stats that I believe in with Jokic, the defensive stuff where he was second defensive win shares behind Tatum for the entire season. You're just like, okay, that's not really what's happening. Because if you watch too and what Golden State's doing, there are big players where if they're near the rim, it gets you thinking about your drive. It just is. And maybe we don't do a good enough job quantifying what that stuff is. I remember the old Sloan MIT paper about how block shots are overrated because they basically never led to possession, because when you block a shot, you hit it out. I've also heard people argue like people should be better at blocking shots and then retaining possession. I don't know that it's as easy as that. I know Bill Russell was really good at it, but I think anybody that's ever played, like when you're going up to try to time somebody to block the shot, if you were timing it to also retain possession, it would just be another element in your mental timing that would kind of screw up your ability probably to block as many shots. But there's another larger point. It's kind of like rebounding. It's not so much how many rebounds you get. It's also how hard you make it to rebound around you. And there are just so many plays throughout an entire night. Well, you'll see this. You're like, okay, he didn't get the rebound, but the reason his team has the rebound or the reason this other guy's struggling or he's exhausted is because you're just tough to deal with rebounding wise. I think a lot of people understand this. And so when I look at some of the defensive stuff for Jokic, who is, yes, a better defender, and we're going to get to this with the Rudy Gobert stuff shortly here as well, but you can see that there's no thought of, oh, no, Jokic is there, where I think when Embiid is around the paint, certainly Gobert in certain instances, you know, Bam is different, because we'll get to that a little bit later when we talk Miami, but you can just see that Golden State's like, we don't care. We're ready to go. So we're seeing a lot of predictable after the fact Jokic shouldn't be MVP stuff, and it comes from the Embiid camp. But I don't know when this is going to go away. Maybe is it going to go on forever? It could, maybe until next year's MVP. But I think what's really, really frustrating about some of the arguments that are crazy is that if you look at Jokic, you say, oh, well, you know, more made up numbers, non ballers. I saw Hanlon again, Embiid's trainer, saying you shouldn't have a vote unless you can make a left-handed layup and shoot a free throw. I feel good about that contest for me personally. But the funny part about the argument is when you say Jokic is really good and all these stupid numbers that don't mean anything. And again, I've just admitted I think the defensive stuff was completely overblown. The rest of the overall stats for Jokic that he's amazing at and led the categories in, you know who's like number 2 or 3 in almost all of them? Embiid or Giannis. So you can't simultaneously shit on Jokic for having awesome numbers and these supposedly stupid numbers while your candidate is right there with everybody else. Win shares, Jokic 1, Embiid 3. Offensive win shares, Jokic 1, Embiid 4. PER, Jokic 1, Embiid 3. VORP, who everybody makes fun of because it sounds stupid, Jokic 1, Embiid 3. Defensive win shares, as I mentioned, Jokic was second, Embiid's 4th. Best plus minus through the entire season, Jokic 1, Embiid 3. That's box score plus minus, which relates also to total points added. Jokic is first, Embiid is 3rd. So whenever you're making fun of those numbers, you're actually discrediting your own candidate if you're on social media constantly talking about Embiid. But here's a very simple part of this. Look at what Golden State's doing from 3 right now. You've got Poole shooting 59% from 3, Steph 50%, Klay 44%, Wiggins is at 60%. That's on 28 three-point attempts through 2 games. You're not going to beat anybody when the other team shoots like that. And Denver has a ton of problems other than a frustrated, ejected Jokic in game 2. Let's get to the Rudy Gobert part of this, because coming in at number 3, I always feel like this is complicated. I felt like I've been on an island for this for a little while now, and we knew what Dallas was going to do. We mentioned it in the preview, especially not having the Doncic part of this. But they've made the adjustment. They went full Clipper small in game 2. Maxi Kleber hit a million shots. There's also a turnover number in there that's incredibly alarming. And Donovan Mitchell, who, yes, I really like, takes it upon himself. And then the whole doesn't pass to Gobert thing, those guys don't pass to him. Gobert completely fumbled a point-blank shot at the rim at 6:30 left in the fourth quarter. He never touched the basketball again. He had a post on the left block earlier in the game where he tried to do like a baseline pivot against the defender, it went off his foot. I think people were laughing about it. And unfortunately for Rudy, you're tasked with covering the rim, protecting the rim, which is really covering for your perimeter defenders, because Mitchell was terrible on defense last night. And they just don't have, I mean, Mike Conley got toasted by Jalen Brunson. Shout out to Brunson. Shout out to Kleber for what they did offensively, coming back and winning this game. Mitchell has been inefficient. But I feel like whenever you question the Gobert defensive impact thing, there's a, and you know, this almost relates to the Jokic thing a little bit, is that I like some of the numbers. I use a lot of the numbers. I'm not blind and married to all of them. You got to be a little malleable with this stuff. And I've never been more malleable about what some of the overall numbers are than I am with Rudy Gobert, because I know what his on-off thing is. I know what he means to this Utah defense, which definitely slipped this year. I think Rudy wasn't exactly to his standard. But when I see somebody become a liability in playoff games this often, I don't understand why there's an argument against it. And that's what Dallas did. And it's a hard assignment to do both things. So it's not all on him. It's not all on Gobert and the Clippers thing, but it's also something that you're going to attack. And I don't know if I'm early on this. I don't know. There's some people who are just going to say I'm completely wrong, but I've felt for years now, there's never been a bigger separation between regular season and playoff basketball. And Gobert may just straight up be a victim in all of this. I take Bam defensively in a playoff series, even against a bigger player. I would take him over Gobert every single day of the week. That gets us to number four, spite rankings. The Heat culture was terrific in game one. If there was a team that was going to be able to get through all the Jimmy Butler nonsense that we saw, like even if it was entertaining, even it's like, hey, here we go with Jimmy Butler again, which is fair because this is a real thing. If there was one team where it just wasn't really going to matter that much, it's the Heat. Now, some would argue, I think Bill was going more with the playoff scheduling for Atlanta, having to play all those games. And then the Heat, I believe, what, one game in 9 days. So tons of extra time. I also just think that the Heat are so locked in defensively and what they did with Trey, that Trey's got to figure out some counters here quickly. You got to get the ball moving. You got to move once you get rid of the basketball. I think some smart teams, and it's very simple. Hey, they're doubling our main guy, our main offensive guy who has the ball in his hands and is bringing it up. Get it out of his hands immediately. Run him through a screen, come back up and catch it again. Yes, it takes off time of the shot clock, and we got to be quicker in decisions now with like 12 left on the shot clock as opposed to initiating our offense at like 18. But it does seem to work, because when you go through one thing, it seems like teams don't defend the second team or the second thing as well. I think Phoenix defends the second thing well, and the Heat certainly do, but that's going to be something they're going to have to do. But it's back to the Bam part, because I love Bam. Switching into Bam is not anything anybody ever wants to do. It's not like, hey, let's get a switch into Bam. But Bam was upset about not winning Defensive Player of the Year. Marcus Smart won it. Congrats to Smart. I was surprised that Smart won it with that many votes. I don't think he was the single best defensive player all season long. That's fine. I'm not going to get a huge fight about it. I think there were so many different options this season. But Bam saying the Heat didn't get it because of national TV exposure is ridiculous. There's some weird post not getting an award complaints that we've seen that are just strange overall. Like Jordan Poole not winning Most Improved Player. I voted for him. It's okay that he didn't win it. I mean, people are acting like, like this is some of the results that come in, and we're like, wait, you guys care that much about Most Improved Player? Like, what's that? So Bam was like, we're not on TV enough. It's Bam, you missed 26 games, man. You missed 26 games. Smart played almost the entire season. So that's what happened there. Hell, I voted Jaren Jackson, and I'm not even sure that I'm right about that either. Higher in the playoff power rankings, middle fingers. The middle fingers do not bother me. I do think it's a little weird that you have an NBA player just flicking dudes off left and right throughout a playoff game. But I don't know that we got a ton of thought on this. Like, were people really outraged? I don't know that they were. Do you want to find outrage? We can always find outrage. We can find outrage on anything. But like real people that you respect, are they going on TV saying this is the worst thing ever? I don't know. I don't watch a ton of the sports topic shows because I have work to do. But I don't think that many people are that upset. And at this point, if you're still pro Kyrie, you're never changing your mind. And if you're anti Kyrie, you're never changing your mind. And I'm probably in that. But as much as I can appreciate what he did. But I wonder if the heckling, which seemed like it was not working the entire time, if it actually worked on that last possession where Kyrie wanted that jumper so bad, which he has a tendency to do. But, you know, so do the great players, because they want that shot. They want to be able to prove it and walk off and have everything. But I think the middle finger part of it's weird in that it's like, oh, that is kind of Like, we don't see that a ton. And if David Stern were commissioner, I think we would have a different news topic on that to deal with. All right, last one here. Lower in the power rankings, perfect games in baseball. We didn't get to the Clayton Kershaw thing. I think it sucks that he gets yanked 80 pitches in. I mean, that's the whole point. It's like, well, what if he's going to have 100-plus pitches? Well, that's the whole point, is it's a perfect game. Nobody's getting on base, so his pitch count is lower. The stress of pitches is different. 80 pitches in one game may be different from 80 pitches in a different game. But we have so many no-hitters, not so much perfect games. We had 9 no-hitters last year, 2021. So a lot like three-point shooting and trying to compare to different eras. You're like, hey, it's a different sport. Some of the pitching numbers are like this, where you go, okay, I can see what somebody's doing in this era historically and how it stacks up against other things. I just think it's completely different because guys don't care about striking out all the time. That's why we had 9 no-hitters in 21, 13 total no-hitters in the 1980s. Hey, Hoops fans, don't just watch all the NBA playoff action. Be a part of it with FanDuel, an official partner of the NBA. Right now, all new customers get a risk-free bet up to $1,000. Just place any bet on the NBA playoffs, and if you don't win, you'll get up to $1,000 back in site credit. So it's almost like a do-over. So if you're on the fence about it, like, well, hey, I can get this wrong, and then I can just do it all over again. That's the point. The app is safe, and it's easy to use. Get your winnings fast. Tons of betting options. I'm going to look at a couple games here for you. All right, so straight lines on the 3 games for tonight. Heat are favored by 7.5. Grizzlies favored by 7. Phoenix favored by 10. I think I like the dogs just from the point totals. Those are high point totals for game twos after getting to know each other a little bit here. I mean, Phoenix felt like they could have won that game by 30, and they let the Pelicans back into it until Chris Paul fourth quarter the hell out of you. But I think I'd like the points. The one that I would focus in here, the highest total for any of the 3 games, Minnesota to Memphis is at 240. I just wonder if that game's going to just be... They're not going to have as many free throws. I think we're almost 70 combined free throws, so that's going to mess with the total. I would think that's not going to happen again. And just a little bit more familiarity with what each are going to do, especially after, look, they played 4 times in the regular season, so this isn't exactly new. But if I had to, under 240, second time facing each other. So there you go. Download FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook today, using the promo code Ryan, R-Y-E-N, and place your risk-free first bet for a chance to take home a W on basketball's biggest stage. Remember to use the promo code Ryan, R-Y-E-N, for this amazing offer. Must be 21 and older and present in select states only. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable site credit that expires 14 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See full terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text Next Step to 53342 in Arizona, 1-800-789-7777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-GAMBLER, or visit fanduel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, New Jersey, PA, Virginia, or 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help, Michigan, 1-877-8 Hope, New York, or text Hope, New York, 467-369, New York, Tennessee Redline, 1-800-889-9789, Tennessee, or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net, West Virginia. From The Athletic, does a great job covering the Warriors, the 2-0 up on Denver Warriors. It's Anthony Slater. All right, this has looked really good. I think a lot of us knew this was probably not a great matchup for Denver. Denver's not that good, and it's been even more horrifying. What have you seen the first 2 games?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you mentioned, particularly without Murray and Porter, they get, Jokic can be targeted in all the screen action they want, which tires them out on the offensive end. I think that's an important part of that strategy. And they just, they're guard defenders, like Will Barton, Monty Morris, okay, I guess, defensively. Austin Rivers is supposed to be their, like, Curry ace off the bench. I mean, I wouldn't even have him in, like, the top 20 Curry defenders in the league. So they just can't do anything, but how the Warriors have looked has mattered. Not just that they're up 2-0 on Denver. What Draymond has done, you know, with the Jokic matchup has shown he should be able to go small ball center all playoffs, essentially. And then I'm sure you want to get to the Jordan Poole stuff, but if Jordan Poole is just going to be like a second Steph Curry on the floor, like that seems difficult to defend.
All right. We could go in a million. Let's just do the Jordan Poole part. I voted for him for most improved player.
I did too. Yeah, I did too.
And I remember hearing, because I had mentioned, like, I think he was eighth in overall plus minus last year. I'm going, okay, wait a minute. Some of that's connected to Steph. And then I think there was another Golden State Warriors media member. I don't forget who it was. And I don't mean to say that to be dismissive, but it was like, hey, it's not. You don't watch the games. They're different rotations. So then I went to Second Spectrum. I go, well, can you sort this for me? And they were like, yeah, there's still enough minutes there with Steph that Jordan Poole's not eighth in plus minus in a normal situation over the course of an NBA season. But it was a sign, right? It was a sign of improvement and his confidence and a little bit more of like, oh, wait, is this guy showing me some things? But then to see this, where it doesn't look like anybody can guard him and he has it all. He has the full package and you can't stand from him and he can shoot and he's as confident as anybody out there. Give me your Jordan Poole like timeline, but then also like Bill and I have started doing like, what if he is this good? Like how different do you have to look at him and then the future of the Warriors?
Yeah, I mean, preseason, I think I was on Zach Lowe's podcast and I was like, he might be going towards CJ McCollum range. I'm like ducking. I'm like, that sounds terrible. But then
I might have told you were crazy. So, you know,
that's what I mean. I was saying like, I felt like I was saying that to a national audience and they were going to be like, what is this guy talking? CJ McCollum for this kid. Now, like, that seems like a floor almost. But anyway, his timeline, it is... fascinating, really. I mean, we're talking 28th overall pick comes into a dynasty that has just died, at least temporarily, right? Clay's out for the year, basically vacationing away from the team. Draymond's uninterested in the season. Steph breaks his hand 5 games into it. They're 15-50 that year. He is forced into the rotation, and he was maybe the worst rotation player in the league. I mean, I think the December of his rookie year, he was like 1 of 20 on 2-pointers and like 0 of 16 on threes. Like the I think he finished the season 28% overall, 28% for three, 30-something% overall. And then the pandemic hits and he's basically an afterthought. They don't go to the bubble. You are basically entering his second season, which happens way further away than you thought, thinking like they whiffed at 28, which they had done. They whiffed on Jacob Evans at 28. It was, you know, that's not catastrophic.
That's the whiff neighborhood, by the way.
Yeah, it really is. But you're talking to people behind the scenes, you know, Chris DeMarco is the coach that works with him closest and some of the other people that during the bubble, they were allowed to go one basket, one coach, like one player. Coach got to wear a mask and like gloves. But he was watching, Poole was watching like the bubble playoffs and watching Tyler Hero, the way Tyler Hero moves off the ball and scores. They're very similar games. And he was like sending clips to DeMarco, like, hey, let's go in the gym tomorrow, work on this, run me through some of the Tyler Hero stuff. And I'm sure you've heard all the stories. Like, he is one of those obsessive workers behind the scenes. And I know that gets overplayed in sports, but, you know, people that work hard like Draymond Green have worked themselves to this point are impressed with his work. So that's how he got better, got his body stronger. Year two, they signed Brad Wanamaker to play over him. And Steve Kerr did play Brad Wanamaker over him, which in retrospect looks like, you know, a rough decision, but it sends him to the G League bubble. He's basically the best player in the G League bubble. That convinces Kerr finally to put him in the starting lineup. But Steve has been on this hype of, you know, he's not a true point guard and he's always wanted to, have a ball handler out there with him. That's why he wanted Wanamaker with him. And then Nico Mannion, actually, when he brought Pull back from the bubble. He's like, well, we can't play him at backup point. It's got to be Nico Mannion out there with him. Finally, he has allowed Jordan Poole a little bit more reign. And you saw this season what he's done with it.
So this guard lineup, which I had been told, like, okay, what do you think the plan will be with this team? You know, and it was just, we're going to throw all those dudes out there at the same time and just see if it can't be defended. And right now, Denver can't defend it. What's the number that you had this morning? Again, it's real, but it's kind of fake, but it's also absurd.
So they're plus 29 in 11 minutes. That's a 204 offensive rating and a 75 defensive rating. I think it's like 42-11 or something, you know, 42-13.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's broken open both games. Denver's been in both games, and then second quarter, he finally goes to it. And it's just a little like 4-minute pocket, game's over. Now the question becomes moving forward, like, got to start this lineup. Draymond, do you hear Draymond at the podium last night?
Yeah.
Somebody asked him, you know, Steph Curry, sixth man, best sixth man you've ever seen, like a joking question. He's like, look, Steph Curry's starting. But then he was like, I think Jordan Poole should be starting too. And then you're just like, all right, well then who's coming out? To me, it's clearly going to end up being Looney. I think that lineup starts against Memphis or Minnesota. And that is just who they ride with, I think, going forward. And then you could back up Draymond with Looney. But I think in the modern age, with how Draymond's looking, like, he should just start at center.
Have you had moments then? Because I've joked and made fun of myself, as I mentioned in the open, because there was an open that we did, and then Steph got rolled up, and I taped it the night before, which I never do. And I called Kyle, my producer. I go, hey, just cut that open, because now Curry got rolled up, and I don't know. I felt like prior to that game, that's how much I was looking forward to that Boston game, but I was like, I think I'm starting to feel things again. I'm worried about the frontline depth, which maybe we'll touch on here a little bit, but even if it's Denver, but having these three guys back, and then Poole playing like this, and this is the best Clay has looked. Do you start to have like little moments of going, wait, do I have to think that this team can now get out of the West, or is that just still crazy?
Yeah, I mean, it's because of how Draymond looked and Poole's looked. And you know, we can mention Steph. He did have 34 points in 23 minutes off the bench last night. But I'm writing about this tomorrow, but this Draymond Poole connection that has formed over the last month, I don't think it should be kind of, I guess, understated or overstated, whatever. Early in the season, there was a moment, you know, Jordan Poole started at the two in Klay Thompson's place, and they played a few months together, were really good. They went 18-2 to start the season, but Poole was the kind of still playing his a little erratic game, always looking for his own, and he kept rejecting Draymond's screens. And there was, they were beating, I think it was the Wolves, and there was suddenly a blow up on the bench that went viral. Like, whoa, Draymond Green's going after Jordan Poole. They're up like 11 and they're 10-1 right now. What's going on? And it was because Poole kept rejecting his screens in the half court and trying to take guys one-on-one. And Draymond kept trying to impress on him, like, look at what I do with Steph. You can use the DHOs. You can use my screens. I can make the game much easier for you. And there was never that type of connection. And then Draymond's belief is because Steph was out the last month, blessing in disguise, he said, he could suddenly just start working on that stuff with Jordan Poole. And he said, even himself, look, if Steph's not out there, I was just looking for someone. Because I think we all know, like, Draymond's kind of relying on that too, right? I mean, because if Steph or Jordan Poole's not out there, he kind of gets somewhat embarrassed offensively. They sag off him. He can't DHO a shooter because there's no shooter out there. So they did that the last month. And to me, that exploded Jordan Poole even more. I don't know how much, like, you've probably noticed it lately. He's basically doing the Steph stuff.
Yeah, but it's a great point on Draymond, too, because if you're turning down Draymond screens, then he's like, what am I doing out here? Like,
yeah.
Right? Because, I mean, the whole point is either I get the ball off the double or, you know, look, the back cut stuff that we saw last night, too, is hilarious. I mean, we had the Clay cut because two stay with Steph, but then you see some of the shit happens with Poole now where you're like, this is all like it's the best version of basketball because it's like, hey, if you just give a little bit more effort than what other teams do in the half court, your life is going to be so easy here. And once people figure that out, then this is that kind of an explosion.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because, you know, they've had Wiseman, they have Kuminga now. And sometimes there's the thought of like run high pick and roll with those two guys. They're great dive men with Steph. And I know Kerr's point at times is like, so we're putting Draymond in the corner. He's the stationary in the corner, like where they're obviously ignoring him. So they run a unique style. But what they didn't have last season when they had Wiseman out there not knowing where to go and Kelly Oubre, who, you know, plays a unique style in itself that does not fit the Warriors. They have guys this season that just know how to run how they want to run. And you're seeing that all come together with even Iguodala. I know he didn't play yesterday, but he's been back lately too, which stabilizes the second unit. And it is a really, really good matchup for them, Denver, but how they've looked makes you wonder how far they can go.
Yeah. It's really the question here because I'm always going to give them the benefit of the doubt because of the Steph part of it. But now when Draymond looks like this and Clay looks like this, but then I'll keep coming back and being like, you kind of knew this was going to happen with Denver. And once you've seen the playoffs, be like, all right, this team isn't really that good. And the defensive stuff with Jokic, although I think better, but exposed last year in the playoffs, but better in the regular season part of it. You can see when they're getting the ball and they kind of swing it to the other side and then there's an angle on the drive, those guys couldn't be happier to have Jokic standing under the rim. Like, it's pretty funny how they was like, yeah, whatever. We don't care. We're going right at you every time. There's just nothing. There's no resistance there, right? I mean, have you seen some of that stuff? I don't know if it's even been touched on in some of the post-game stuff, but it's one thing to have spacing in a lane run. It's another thing to have spacing and no fear.
No rim protection. Yeah. I mean, in Aaron Gordon, I mean, we don't need to get into an Aaron Gordon conversation, but is he their second best player? And if he is, he's had a horrible series on both ends, right? They're sagging off of him, and then he just doesn't do much. But to me, I'm already I actually don't think it's unwise. I'm already looking at the other matchups, right? If it is Memphis, you know, Jaren Jackson, small ball center, and they're out there, and they got Dylan Brooks hounded some of these guys, and Desmond Bane, and that is a much stiffer challenge. And there's been moments early in these Denver games, right? They're up 8 middle of the second quarter where they're pressing a little bit more up on them. And the worst, like throwing sloppy turnovers, like they get pretty turnover happy, but Denver's not turning them over. Whereas that's what Memphis does. That's why Memphis was successful against them this season. That matchup's a lot scarier. And that to me is why you start Jordan Poole right away. Because usually when the Warriors look their most congested offensively, it's when Kevon Looney and Draymond Green are on the floor together. I just don't think you can do those minutes against Memphis. And then beyond that, how good did Phoenix look defensively the other day? And just, there's just so many more tougher challenges defensively waiting for this offense.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I think you also have to include a possibility in Minnesota and then wondering, okay, well, how would that Towns matchup work out? Because even if you feel like this other team, like Ayton or Towns, and you're like, oh, well, they're just going to go into the post against the spot. Nobody does it. You're not going to run 20 post ISOs for DeAndre Ayton. You're not going to do it with Towns, especially when Towns proves to have a shooting season that he just had. So you could probably still survive with the lack of depth. But that's the part of it that I know there was always hope that Wiseman would come back. But even if Wiseman is going to be good and was going to be healthy, a guy who's barely played basketball for 3 years to say, oh, now, by the way, you're part of our playoff run with high expectations, not just, hey, we're happy to be here as a 7 or 8 seed. Are you surprised they didn't find a way to maybe give a little depth up front, or were they just sort of in a roster crunch where they liked so many of their other players?
Well, it's kind of the faulty part of their developmental plan. Win now, develop now is kind of how it's been termed around here. But like they wanted a path cleared for James Wiseman. He was the second overall pick. Like, you think Joe Lacob wanted, Robin Lopez standing in James Wiseman's way to playing time? No. And the problem for them is it wasn't like December came along, he had the second knee surgery, and it was like, okay, out for the season. It was always like 2 weeks away, 2 weeks away, 2 weeks away. And it's just the way it, I guess, materialized allowed them always to think that this, the mystical James Wiseman was looming 2 weeks away. And it never let them add when they probably should have for this season purposes. They always should have. But they were trying to clear a path for James Wiseman. And that is the one part of this plan that has really worked out against them, because looks like they hit on Kuminga, looks like they hit on Moody. They developed the hell out of Jordan Poole. Everything kind of is working well for them, except for the Wiseman part. And either that's not going to matter because Draymond Green is just going to, roam around all playoffs and do what he's doing to Jokic, to Towns or Jackson, to Ayton, whatever. Or Draymond's going to wear down. Looney's not going to be enough, and you're going to be sitting there when they're down 3-1 in the West Finals going, man, they should have added extra help at the big spot.
What's the pool money approach here? Because Max, you think they'll get in front of it?
I think, well, sorry, I was talking from the pool perspective. And the pool perspective
I get that part, yeah.
The pool perspective is if a Max is not on the table now, he's a guy who has shown like he is going to get better. Like he just, that's what he does. He gets better because he's in the gym like crazy. So if Max isn't on the table, he should go see you in restricted free agency. Sacramento Kings right up the road. Maybe they'll Max me or the Magic with an offer sheet. So if that's not on the table, I just don't think it gets done this summer at this point with how he's looked on this stage. From a Warriors perspective, the tax crunch that they're in. But what's key, and I think it gets lost in this conversation about Poole's money. Yes, he's extension eligible this summer, but the money doesn't kick in until the season after. He's only making $3.9 million regardless next season if an extension is agreed upon. And Andrew Wiggins, who, what is he, at $33 million at this point, his contract is up after next season. So the moment Wiggins is up is when Poole's extension would kick in. You could essentially just replace those two contracts. And at this point, I think it's pretty clear organizationally, like Jordan Poole has hopped Andrew Wiggins in the future pecking order. So we'll see how they want to move money around, but that is the easy answer. You can just replace Wiggins' money with Poole's money.
There was always this kind of thought of the next guy. I never quite understood the Beal thing because I feel like he's a ball stopper. And that's why I think when Paul George was available and I'd heard rumors about like whether or not Golden State would be interested, and you're just like, yeah, but you have to buy into what they're doing. You can't be a ball stopper while now everybody's watching you. And even Durant, I think to his, you know, look, it was easy for Durant because Durant's incredible, but to his credit, I don't think he ball stopped the way he could somewhere else, like all the ISO that he can run in Brooklyn. And feel free if you disagree with any of that, just jump in. But hey, would they throw Wiseman? Would they throw Kuminga? Would they throw Poole? You know, use the Wiggins money or any of that kind of stuff? Does it feel like, and we don't really know the answer to this because maybe the next mad guy wants to play there and it's a no-brainer, but does it feel like the packaging, all of the assets is being replaced by, we're just going to ride it out with the development of our own guys? Because it seems like Kuminga, the ceiling for him, you know, after it worked, it's like, well, maybe just you stay pat here and try to just schedule out the contracts and keep it together instead of throwing three for one somebody else to fit in with our culture.
Yeah, and the truth is, like, the decision makers up top, and I mean, you know the names, Joe Lacob, Bob Myers, but particularly obviously Lacob, this has always been the plan. You know, the Bradley Beal noise is like veterans, like knowing guys in the league that they think can help them win this season. You know, it's why in training camp, I don't know how much you follow the noise, but like, they preferred Avery Bradley. Front office preferred Gary Payton the second, because like they just felt it was like a developmental piece that had a higher, you know, potential value for them, not even just this season and beyond. They went Payton, and the veterans were upset they didn't do Bradley. Now, obviously, that has tilted towards the front office. Like, that was a good decision. I just, like, Joe Lacob cares about 2025, 2026, 2027. He has publicly come out and, you know, even had quotes. I remember I did an interview with him after the draft about Kuminga, and he was like, he even named the Lakers. He's like, I don't want to be the Lakers that, you know, tries to chase down one or two titles and squeak it out and mortgage the next six seasons. He's like, the Lakers went six seasons, I think he said, without making the playoffs, if that's the correct number. He doesn't want to do that. Now, there are drawbacks to that. You're seeing it with what we just mentioned with Wiseman. Their obsession with, you know, having a clear path for Wiseman probably hurt what their depth could have been, particularly in the front court this season. But this is their plan. And I just don't think Lacob is running off of it. I think it would be more likely that he turns away from the current era over the next couple of seasons than he leans in hard and is like, Kuminga's gone, Wiseman's gone, Poole, at this point, not Poole, for Pascal Siakam or, you know, Ben Simmons whoever. Like you said, name your star. I just think he, at this point, believes he's grooming like the next playoff version of his core that includes a lessened version of Curry, Clay, and maybe Draymond.
This is very obvious in that, because the personality of Steph and Clay and even Durant when he was there, they're kind of, maybe passive isn't the right word, but they're not super emotionally charged guys, which is why Draymond's energy is needed. I always feel like successful teams, you need something like that. But it's funny seeing Poole and the pass that he had to be Elisa last night, and then Draymond's reaction on the bench, and then Gary Payton the second, which I didn't love him, you know, doing that to Jokic.
He does that all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Jokic being pissed about Gary Payton blocking a shot and then patting his ass and being like, don't touch me. Like, I totally understand.
Agree.
Especially when it's like, no offense to Gary Payton the second, but if you're at Jokic's level, you're like, what the fuck? You're just doing. But seeing that you've got these two younger dudes that have a little bit more Draymond in them than the other guys, it's almost like a new layer of swagger for this team that didn't usually have like a lot of guys like this, just do their job and make shots and embarrass you. And now you got guys that want to embarrass you and also tell you about it, which is why I think I've seen like different cutaways to Draymond where he's laughing his ass off, because this is kind of like a new thing.
Yeah, and I'd add Kuminga into that. I mean, he'll dunk on you, and he has a kind of a spectacular game that I'm not sure how much will be showcased in the playoffs. Like, maybe he'll get cameos, but right now he's obviously out of the rotation. I agree. It is, the personality is shifting a little bit. The funny thing is, I mean, like, you know, Poole and Draymond have, I mentioned the little blow up earlier on the bench. There's been clashes with them. I mean, even early in Poole's rookie season practices, where he came in with that confidence level, and, you know, obviously there's a Michigan State rivalry. They're always chirping about that rivalry in the locker room. But Poole has proven to them that he can be trusted to win, and they've been crazy hard on him. Steve Kerr has been really hard on him. Iguodala has given him tough lessons. We've written about a few of them. There was a funny one in like the players union when Poole was in a slump and he threw the ball off the TV screen in like the Players Union practice facility and like cracked it a little bit. And Iguodala is one of the reps for the Players Union. And just like he was in the gym, he does like a theatrical walk over and look at it like, you're going to pay for that. I'm going to have to tell the whole league, like, you know, this is why $450 is coming out of everybody's checks. And like, he's just, they're always keeping him in line. And what they've liked about him, and you talked to, it's like he has taken it. He's taken the bad coaching. He's taken the benching at times this season. There'll be four people will make a defensive mistake over a bad sequence during the regular season. But the last one was Jordan Poole missing a box out, let's say that. And it's like, timeout, Steve Kerr. Everyone's getting up. Mike Brown is right in Jordan Poole's face. Iguodala is coming over. And I think there's been at times a lot of Jordan Poole this season, like, really me again? Like, how about Draymond can't make a jumper? So, you know, something like that. But he has absorbed it well and has come out better for it. And now, to me, the relationship between Draymond and Poole is very strong.
Were you in the building last night?
Yeah.
Okay. Was Denver mad at each other for 2.5 hours? What was going on the bench? Because the broadcast did not really do a great job.
It wasn't a full game, obviously. They were up 8. They were playing pretty well. And then when that lineup came in, Denver just got completely discombobulated. Their matchups kept getting screwed up in transition. Gordon was on Steph. There was at one point Jokic was on Poole. Remember when Jokic just crashed into Jordan Poole as he's shooting a three? There was just like a lot of that going on. It was so disorganized. And clearly coming into game two, like pregame, that's all Malone was talking about. Like, we have to be better communicating. So that seemed to be at the core of like what was going on. There was one possession where Denver made a shot. You might remember Steph walked up in transition and was like, nobody's picking me up. And he just pulled up from three. And Monte Morris or Barton, I remember, did one of those like looking around, like they were starting to yell at each other. And then as he's going to the bench, Cousins says something to him. Don't know what DeMarcus Cousins said. I've had plenty of conversations. I used to cover DeMarcus Cousins. He can be a little bit mean at times with like those short little comments. Clearly it pissed Barton off. They go at it. It was the microcosm of the night. They kind of had a little mini scuffle on the bench. What was crazy about it, though, is only the little corner of the arena that was near the Denver bench saw it, but Draymond saw it, and he ran out to center court during the timeout and was telling everyone, like, get up, like, yell at them, basically. And then in postgame, he criticized the fans. He's like, they got to see that sooner. They got to get louder quicker. They got to be on them.
Yeah, we'll see if there's another one in that building again for this series. Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate your work.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
I love living here because there's always different options. A lot of people like to go to Lakers games and try to get courtside seats. I am more of a South Bay Lakers guy, and I got courtside to the Lakers and the Warriors affiliate, Santa Cruz, and I got to see the G League Rookie of the Year, Mac McClung, up close and personal, and Mac joins us now. What's up, man? This is a lot of fun. I'm fired up to do this.
What's up, guys? I appreciate you guys having me on. Me too.
All right, so what was this year like for you?
It was definitely a mental grind. I think, you know, I have so much respect for people in the G League, and, you know, it's easy to, you know, look at other people's races and try to compare yours to them. But I think the biggest thing I learned was just to work on myself each day and try to be the best version of myself and not focus on someone else's race or, someone else's journey. So, it's challenging, you know. Shout out to guys like Andre Ingram, who been in this league for 10, 11 years. So it's a grind, and I definitely respect the G League.
Yeah. So you were with the Lakers and then you're not with them. And then you get picked up by the Bulls, right? I'm just trying to get the timeline right. and you get into an actual Bulls game for 2 minutes, I love that you get a jumper up immediately. Were you telling yourself like, hey, get a shot up here, get on the board?
Yeah, I think I was like being aggressive, just kind of play like I was playing well in the practices. So I was like, I felt good. I felt confident. Yeah, I just kind of just said, I'm gonna let the game come to me. If it's open, it's open. And you know, the fans, they were like, they wanted a bucket bad. So I just tried to try to give them what they wanted.
If you go back and kind of, you know, you get picked back up by the Lakers. Before we go back in time here, you get picked back up by the Lakers. You know, you play, I think, what, 26 games with South Bay Lakers. And then you get called up to play in that last game, Denver. Can you kind of take us through, like, what's your understanding? Because you're putting up numbers. You're hoping to get a call up. The Lakers season isn't going nearly the way they thought it was. What kind of communication are you having with your agent and your people and going like, hey, am I close? Am I going to get called up? Because I'm sure they wanted to keep you in South Bay to see what would happen with the playoffs. But there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah, there was a lot going on. You know, there's multiple times you know, my agent hit me and we thought we were a certain situation to get out. Even my South Bay GM thought I was going to be gone certain times, and I was still there for weeks and weeks and weeks because the way I was playing. But I kind of fell in love with, you know, South Bay, and I was like, man, I just want to win a championship here. Like, that's, we all really like each other, and that kind of became the focus. That's where my mind was at, was just like, man, if we can win a championship this year, that would be great. And I love the guys I was with, so I didn't look at it as like, oh, I'm ready to get out of here. I was like, man, can I keep growing here? Can we win for South Bay? And that was kind of my mentality throughout the year.
So you play in that Denver game. Talk about being baptized into the Lakers and the NBA life. Give me the lead up, because at that point the season's kind of over for them. And you know, I know Austin went off as well. But what was the lead up to being like, okay, I'm back in this, and I have a real game to go here, and I'm going to play.
Yeah. So when I got there, well, the 2 days before, when our season was over, my agent was like, yeah, like, this is a big possibility. This, you might get the two-way with the Lakers. And I was just like patient, because, you know, I was like, I'm either going to go home or I'm either going to be with the Lakers. And they told me I was on the two-way and I was going to go play. And then Frank like introduced me and was like, yeah, Max is going to play tonight. And I was like, oh, nice. Like, let's go. You know, I'm excited. And it was great. You know, I definitely underestimated the Denver air, though. I was struggling to breathe, but no, it was a fun game. I don't know if you watched, but it was like a fun game to be part of. Like, came back within, I think it was 9 points with 50 some seconds or something like that. It was just, you know, Austin Reeves was unbelievable. It was a lot of fun.
So, but people know this about you. You were like the first Instagram dunker. Like, you were almost before Zion in a way. Like, I remember hearing about you being like, have you seen this kid? This kid? And, you know, Van Pelt and I'd be watching the videos being like, holy shit, look at this guy. And so you've had, like, your name's been out there for a while. Did any of the other guys, the established guys, LeBron, any of those dudes say anything to you when you get introduced and you're around this team?
They definitely, I think, have seen the videos and stuff, but they were super nice to me. But I think they knew who I was. You know, first day I got there, it was a really nice gesture from Anthony Davis. He let me work out with him. I was on the other side about to work out. He's like, you know, come work out with me, you know. So it just kind of shows kind of how those guys were. And they were very open to me. And just like, you know, I loved Rondo, watching Rondo and learning from him. But yeah, all those guys are great guys. And they were real open. And, you know, nobody was really shut off or anything like that.
Yeah, but it was a weird season. And then on top of that, Frank gets fired that night. So what was that experience like for you? Because you're going, hey, I got some points. We had this crazy game in Denver and it was a wild game. And now Frank, who just introduced me, now there's rumors that he doesn't know that he's fired. And look, I know you want a future with the Lakers here, so I don't expect you to be like going crazy or anything. But there's a lot of stuff that you're balancing, the emotions of so many different things happening as the season closed for you and the team.
Yeah, I didn't really know about the situation, but I like Frank as a person. He was good to me, and you know, throughout the game, he's just giving me pointers and stuff. But yeah, I don't really like know how any of that other stuff works. So I just kind of like focus on myself and trying to play well and stay the course. So with that situation, I don't even really know how to comment on it.
Yeah, right. I mean, Mac, I didn't expect you to say, hey, I think it was a huge mistake. As you're sitting here in a two-way trying to figure out like the rest of your NBA career. So let's go back to those high school days. What was the first realization of like, oh, this is real and people are paying attention? All the views, the dunks, the recruiting. What was the first time where you felt like, okay, I might be the same, but now everything around me is different?
Yeah. I really didn't realize for a long time, I don't think. Like you just said, you were talking about, like, I would see there be like, oh, there's 2 million views on this. And there should be like, I didn't understand. Like, people were like, it almost, at some points, I almost felt like everyone was watching when I got in college and stuff. Like, every, like, frat boy would be like, yo, that's Mac. You know what I mean? It was just like, I didn't really understand when I was in high school. The, like, I understand people around my hometown were watching and everything, but I didn't understand, like, how many people knew who I was. Until, like, I would go places and everybody, like, would just look at me and whisper and talk. And I'm just like, obviously, I'm not, like, a celebrity, but it felt like a lot sometimes, you know. Almost a lot of places I would go, I would get stopped and, you know, ask for pictures. And I was like, man, like, this is a lot different. I'm not the kid from Gate City anymore that just fits in everywhere I go. But I think if I could go to a certain story, I went in Vegas. It was as soon as I got out of high school, I went to Vegas for an AAU showcase. And this, like, worker ran out of his store and he was like, you Matt McClung? I was like, how do you know my name? Like, he's like a family member or something. He's like, no, I need a picture, man. I was like, oh, wow. Like, that's, it's a little different now.
How old were you when you threw down your first dunk?
I think it was the end of my freshman year. So I wasn't that athletic. I was like quick and fast, but like my balance wasn't there. I was just obsessed with it. And I finally started dunking around like the end of my freshman year. Not anything cool, but just like regular dunks.
But how tall are you? Like, for like 6'1", 6?
I measured at 6'2", I think, at the combine.
Okay. All right. So, well, how tall were you when you threw down your first dunk?
Probably 5'10". Yeah, 5'10", right. Probably.
But then something happened, like the burst. You know, you like whatever that next level is where you were just throwing down and there was some violence behind it too. Like, I think dunking's weird. Not that I'm some sick dunker, but once you know you can do it, then there's this level of confidence of like, oh, wait, now I'm actually going to try to finish against guys with this, that I can do it. And it's a completely, it opens up so much more because now you're not trying to avoid being blocked and layups and stuff.
Yeah. I became kind of obsessed with it. Like, I was always obsessed. It was like, it was an obsession for me. And it was like my sophomore years when I started, like, I don't know, I was in a warm-up line in the AAU game. I just started, like, I was like, man, I'm getting high. Like, I'm dunking this easy. Let me, like, try to windmill or something. Then I windmilled, and all my teammates were like, oh, my gosh. And then I was like, well, let me try to go between the legs. And I went between the legs. And I was just, like, trying stuff. And I was like, man, like, I feel different. And it was kind of, I think I was just maturing. Like, I don't think I've had any armpit hair in the freshman year, you know what I'm saying? So I think I just matured, and I kind of grew into it. And after that, I was just, my teammates probably hated me. All I was doing was like leaking out for a fast break or trying to get a lob, trying to get a dunk.
But once you get that kind of attention, and you said like, hey, I don't feel like a celebrity, but like that's a celebrity in today's world. You know, like I got a couple teenage kids staying with me and, you know, it's their first time in LA and they're like, are we going to see anybody famous? And then I was like, I don't know, like maybe we'll see some athletes or something. And then they were like, well, we wanted to see. And I'm like, I don't know who you're talking about. Like, and I'm glad I don't know who the hell they're talking about. Like, but they were talking about like TikTok and all these different people that have these houses in LA and all these influencers and stuff. And I'm like, when you think of you, and I think Zion as well, like this was like the first version of this basketball stuff and you were just throwing down dunks. But I have to imagine too, there was a real downside because now you had like a target on you. So how much did that suck playing, and whether it was some of the showcase stuff or just the straight high school stuff where people were like, okay, well now we're going to mess with this dude.
Yeah, I definitely think everyone like comes correct when they see me. And I like that. You know, I think there definitely is a target. The thing that I think bothered me for a while was like, man, like he's this like YouTube guy, like that's just not who I am. Yeah, YouTube followed me, but my story is bigger in the effect of how many like odds I overcome and how hard I work. That's like, that's going to be my story in the end, not like, oh, he can dunk. You know, it's like, man, this guy's been counted out every step of the way. That's what I want my story to be. And I think I had some frustration early on in my life when that was the kind of the story, you being a dunker, a funny YouTube guy. But I think, you know, as I keep going, I don't think that'll be a stigma for too long.
Is the story true about the opposing coach? Because you committed to Georgetown. Was it true that in high school, the opposing coach was telling you you're going to be on the bench at Georgetown and then you went off?
Yeah. I think I think I feel bad because the fans gave him so much trouble, like just blowing up his social media account. But
what happened?
Yeah, I heard him say that. And, you know, it was just, I think I looked at him and I was just like, you know, I said some things, but
put us in the story though. What are you bringing the ball up? And then the opposing coach says what? Like, give me the full details of this.
So I was at the free throw line and he said something and I just laughed and he said, yeah, something, you're going to Georgetown to sit or something like that. I think before I shot three, I said, I'm going to start. And not that I had a guaranteed starting job at the moment, but I believed in myself. And that kind of stuff gets me going. I feel like that's a mistake to say to any player, you know, like that. But I kind of got real hot after that. And I kept looking his way for sure.
So basketball, you know, you're younger, you know, there's certain ages where everybody realizes, oh, maybe I'm not going to play in the NBA. You know, like think of all your buddies, your junior high, and you're like, I'm going to play, you know, I'm going to do this. And then you get to Georgetown. And I mean, is it fair to say maybe it didn't go as well as you thought it would go? You know, that first year at Georgetown where you're like, oh, this might be a little bit harder. And then you transferred to Texas Tech. So what was that like for you? The realization of, I didn't know if you thought it was going to be easier, if it went harder. Take us through that part of your journey of kind of figuring out where you fit in as a basketball player with still aspirations of hopefully playing in the NBA for like full time.
Yeah. Definitely you hit some bumps in the road. I think, you have to grow. I didn't realize like what my, I don't think I played the game the way I was supposed to. You know, I was, probably a shooter first at 6'1", 6'2". And I realized, you know, I need to be a point guard when I left college. And, you know, I got here in South Bay and, you know, I've really changed my game. But, you know, I think the challenges were winning at Georgetown. I love Coach Ewing and the situation. Things happened off the court. That's why I left, not because of my love for Coach Ewing or anything like that. But Texas Tech was great. Chris Beard was great. Wish we went a little farther in the tournament, but I feel like that was a great situation for me.
So you don't get drafted. What are you thinking?
So my, you know, Drew Hanlon was the first person. I was working out with him in the summer. He's like, you know, you're not getting drafted. And I was like, oh man, like you sure? Like, dang, like, you know what I mean? Like I'm talking to some teams, they're saying maybe. He's like, nah, like you're not getting drafted. I was like, okay. And then Jeff Van Gundy, you know, he's staying in touch with me throughout my career, through Patrick Ewing. We knew each other and he was someone that I go to for advice a lot of times. And he said, you know, you're not going to get drafted. He said, you know, the route you're going to take is going to be a grind. So you might as well just go do it. That's what was one of the decisions to leave college. He said, it's going to be a tough grind and it's going to be that either way next year or the next, like you're going to have to work for it and get up there. And I was like, okay, well let's do it. And so I knew kind of what angle I was going to have to take. And I just kind of focused on myself. I knew there was going to be outside voices and everything, but I just said, let me stay the course. I know I'm destined to do this. So I just kind of stayed the course and hopefully I can keep going up.
What else? I love Van Gundy. So what's that relationship been like?
He's just been he's a really good person who is a great basketball mind. So if I ever, you know, he'll check on me from here to there. But if I ever have any questions about like big decisions, I like to text him or call him and see what's going on. So he's just a great resource for me and I'm lucky to have him.
So we know it's a grind. I loved going to the G League game just because I think it was another reminder of just how absurd, like the quickness, you know, like people can watch the NBA and realize, look how big these guys are and how quick they are. And you're like, yeah, okay, the G League, like you play with centers and like all four guys think they're the leading scorer, you know? So there's a lot of like, all right, I got to get mine here because I got to get out of here. And then you're watching dudes, you're like, I still can't believe how quick everybody is, how quick your decisions have to be. And you put up numbers. What was your favorite part of like developing the part of your game where it felt like, at least the way the game that I saw, again, it wasn't like I was watching all of them, like you're going to have to figure out a way to survive, like as a pick and roll guy, right? Like as just high pick and roll, high ball screen, still be a playmaker, but still have the drive shoot option. And it seems pretty straightforward with it, but it's also harder, I think, for you guys, because now there's a lot of guys that want to take turns doing that. And you sub out like almost hockey lines as well. Like you'll sub out a ton of different guys. So it's not like you get to own the game and have a flow the way you would maybe in a traditional game. But I'm curious just from a basketball part of it, like how you feel like you're still being aggressive, but also trying to find a way to develop the skills that make you an NBA player.
Yeah. My whole approach this year was kind of like, I was not pressed to like get shots. Like it was the most I've ever been in life, like being a pass first guy. And then like, I was like, dang, well, it comes out. It always comes back to me, you know, like when I'm unselfish, it always comes back. I get more shots being unselfish and having that mindset and worrying about if this guy has enough shots instead of myself. And then in the late game, you know, the ball would always come to me because they knew I was going to try to make the right play. And that's kind of the approach I took. And I felt like it worked out a lot better because, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of teams that everybody's trying to get theirs. You can tell, you know what I mean? But I think our team, that's why I was so lucky to go in that situation. Great people, great dudes. Everybody wanted everybody to succeed.
Yeah, Miles is a really good coach, like super into it. And I always hear really good stuff about Miles Simon. All right, last thing I want to finish up here. I always think the underdog white guy is always a fascinating basketball story, you know, because you go to Chicago and it's like, hey, it's that guy that dunked on the videos, like huge ovation, which then usually will piss off other dudes. We're like, oh, what is this, like the mascot? And then I'll notice that the G League game, there were some dudes on the other team that were like, no matter what happens, I'm not letting Mac McClung get the best of me. What has that been like, where it's this adoration from the fans because of the backstory, but then also being in the crosshairs of so many other dudes that are like, there's no way I'm letting this guy. And I see guys kind of step to you a little bit and maybe give you a little bit more shit because of who you are in these settings. And that's going to be kind of a weird thing that you've probably experienced your entire playing career.
Yeah, it's hilarious. So I go over a lot of film work and we would watch games and we see how they guard another guard who's like a first team caliber guy or like a maybe even like a, you know, player of the year candidate. And then we see how he guards me. Like, it's just like hilarious, like the attention to detail. Like, I didn't think it was a thing when people would say that. Like, my dad would say that stuff because he was obsessed with all the G League games and watch them. And we would watch them and me and my coach would just like laugh, you know, like how like focused guys would be when they guarded me because of that reason. But I don't see it. Like, I don't even think of it like that. I'm just like, when the ball's up, like, you know, I always tell myself, pray for the bear, like it's on, like I'm just ready to go and I'm focused on winning. So I don't even really think of anything or, you know, think, is this guy guarding me hard? Like it's on from both ways for sure.
Well, it was fun to get to see that experience. And I think everybody that knows how hard it is to get there, like, what are you going to do this off season? Like, I mean, do you have any idea of kind of where you stand? I mean, obviously, it's a lot of work in front of you here, too, so there's no guarantees. But do you have any sense, or do you even allow yourself to have expectations for what next year might be?
You know, you hear things and you want to, I think the worst thing, you can make assumptions, and I don't want to make any assumptions. I'm just going to stay the course. And figure out whatever happens, I feel like is supposed to happen. So I'm just going to work hard and focus on growing each day and it'll all work out, I'm sure.
Well, good luck to you. It was fun. And thanks for doing this, Mac. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You want details? Fine. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Life advice. The email is lifeadvicerr@gmail.com. Okay. Hey, Ryan. Reaching out because I value your opinion. My significant other also values your words as well. Okay. So, nice. We got a female chiming in here. Because usually you don't hear dudes going, my wife loves everything you have to say. So... here's her deal. I'm currently dealing with a very common situation, an overbearing, jealous, and intrusive mother-in-law. There's been a lot of history here that I won't entirely unpack, but there is one situation I'm currently dealing with that I'd like your advice on. Uh-oh. So this is, I wonder if we're being used as a vehicle here as the call out so that the significant other knows what's going on with the intrusive mom. I don't know. Whatever. That's on you. You sent the email in. My basically mother-in-law, mother to the guy I've been dating for 3 years, sees me as competition. And that simple fact has created a huge wedge in her and I's relationship. She lives in the same city as me, and my significant other works for my significant other as his assistant. He owns a construction property management business, and they text mostly every day. She typically keeps her distance from me because of how she feels about me. This week is her birthday. She's requested to my significant other that he and his best friend take her fishing. Only the two of them are invited and no one else. And it would be in my boat that I purchased last year. She knows I would enjoy going, and yet she purposely manipulates my exclusion. Time out here. You got a boat?
Yeah, Cap, my boat. That implies that, you know,
yeah,
obviously you're a roller, and is it not your significant other's boat? Like, it's just your boat. Damn. Hard line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then but he has privileges to use it and for her future mother-in-law to use it. This is a weird situation.
Yeah, hey, can we use your future wife's boat and she can't come?
You're not invited.
Yeah. I would say if it doesn't work out, I think you're going to have a lot of options.
Be like, oh, yeah, cool. I'm free Saturday. Actually, you know, we were just thinking the two of us. Sorry, you know.
Do they refuel it? I mean, that'd be the ultimate. Like, oh, and they didn't put gas in it.
Man, that's harsh. Anyway, okay.
Okay.
So I'm already mad about it.
Yeah, but I feel like she has a great chance to, if it doesn't work out, you know.
Yeah, she's got a boat. Better, she'll be fine.
What better dating profile than, like, loves to stay active, loves dogs, owns a boat. Okay, so the significant other sees nothing wrong with this, says I'm making the situation about myself and I'm being selfish, so I need to get over myself. Well, sounds like, all right, why don't you go rent a fucking rowboat then, buddy? All right, that in itself is toxic, hurtful behavior on his part, but nonetheless, I want your opinion on if I'm misconstruing the situation, turning it into something that it isn't. Would you allow your mother to exclude your wife from plans involving you? Would you stand up for your wife, or would you simply grant your mother her birthday wish and take her out without your wife there? Love your feedback. Well, I'm not the perfect guy there for the end, my hypothetical wife, mother-in-law situation, but it's always kind of a weird dynamic if you break it down like that. I always think one of the weirdest realizations that you have as you get older as a kid is that, like, you look at your mother and father as almost brother and sister, and like, it's family. It's like, no, like at one point, one of them was like super into the other. There's a chance that your dad, you know, was annoying, and then your mother was finally like, okay, fine, or the other way around, where your mom wouldn't leave your dad. And then when you start thinking about your parents as a version of a relationship that obviously was much more serious than maybe what you're dealing with as a younger person. But then as you get older, you start looking at your parents as people that were dating and romantically involved instead of just the immediacy of kind of all that being. It's almost like that does, sometimes it doesn't feel that way when you're younger and you're growing up. So trying to apply some of that to the mother-in-law part of this, is he an only child? If that's the case, yeah, I mean, I think that can get weird sometimes with the protection part of it. You mentioned something in the past, but you didn't want to go there that you didn't want to unpack, which is totally fine. But I'm just wondering if there's something that they went through as a family that has bonded them maybe beyond. And then on top of that she's working for his business, they're going to be texting every day, even if it wasn't his mom, if she's helping him run his business on top of everything else. There are people that have like want to be with their parents all the time. There are people that are really good about being around their parents, and there are people that never want to deal with their parents. Right. So I think anybody that's, you know, depending on which category you fall in, sometimes you'll have a harder time understanding the closeness or lack of closeness of your significant other and their parents. So really what this comes down to is, as you described, and we're only getting your side of this thing, is that it's not even so much about the mother-in-law as it is, how is your future husband going to balance this? Because him saying, hey, you're making it about you, when you feel like the mother-in-law has gone out of her way to exclude you and finds you as this competition, if he's not seeing that, that's going to be a bigger problem than the boat and the birthday and the texting and the daily stuff here. So it is a bit like, hey, whose side are you going to take? The thing that I always think, like in a healthy marriage, like even if it's your mother, this is somebody you're starting a family with. This is somebody who you're signing up to be with every day for the rest of your life if it works out. So the significant other should almost always win. And like, to me, that's the ultimate commitment. So yes, this person could have given birth to you, but you're not living with your mother the rest of your life. You're not starting a family with your mother and planning out, you know, decades in advance, you know, if you're on the same page with the other person. And you can plan, you can say, hey, eventually I'd like to do this. I'd like to have this many kids. I'd like to live here. This is what I'd love to pursue. But if my career doesn't work out, this is something else that I can do. I want to be supportive of you. Like, these are all the real things, the cool shit in good relationships where you grow together and you share this journey together. And there isn't really room. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, like, it's cool when people remain friends later on. But, like, when I hit up guys, like, hey, you going to do something? It's like, dude, it's just not really the way it works, Russillo. Like, I can't just go to Vegas with you for a UFC fight. I'm like, why? Like, why wouldn't she want you to have? He's like, yeah, it doesn't fucking work that way. And it's like, look, I also understand that it doesn't work this way, but I'll still throw the invites out there every now and then. So if he's not more committed to you than he is his mother moving forward, I do think that that's a real problem. And they don't even bother addressing it with the mother-in-law. It doesn't matter. You know, like, it'd be great if the mother-in-law was like, this is amazing. My son, who I love, this is his person. He picked this person. He found her. This is great. It apparently isn't going to go like that, but I don't think there's any resolution to this until you get your future husband more on the same page with how you feel about this. Than trying to battle with the mother-in-law that was totally okay with taking your fucking boat out and making sure that you weren't on it.
This is like, I feel like there are so many romantic comedies, rom-coms, that have been this exact premise where, like, the guy is just way too into his mom and there's, like, way too much of a connection there. And it's always a red flag. Like, it just never, to me, that's never cool. Like, I have a great relationship with my mom, but I would feel really awkward if I told my wife, hey, actually, like, you can't come on your boat to do this thing. Like, and here's the thing is, like, my mom would want Maddie, my wife, to come with us too. So it's a tough situation. I think you're right. The least of her concerns should be the mother-in-law, because there's a good chance you're never going to really win her over anyway if this is the way it is now. But it's all about, like, the dude and figuring out what is the line where you're going to be able to be like, who's the priority here? Am I the priority or is your mom the priority? I know the mom does a lot of things for you, but, like, I am, you know, if I'm this important person in your life, like, I kind of have to be number one. And I don't know if there's any reasoning with that. Like, some guys are just kind of like mama's boys like that. And they kind of like that. They like the security. That's never been my thing, but I think that's kind of a big red flag. I don't know if you do.
Yeah, then I'm the ultimate green flag. But maybe if the boat were an isolated incident, then, I mean, that's kind of what we're always asking here. Is this normal or is this a one-off? If the one-off was like, hey, I just want to fish with my son. Maybe it's something we did when we were younger. And hey, the boat part of it is fucked, because it's like, oh, and by the way, we're using your fucking boat, which is, you know, the boat owner's deal. It's like, wait, you're only like, I'm only worth this to you because I've got a 51-foot sloop out back, you know?
It's one thing if you, like, go out to dinner or a concert or whatever, something that isn't physically someone else's and they're your swing.
And I don't think either of us are saying something absurd. Like, of course, there are going to be times where if you're very close with your mom and who have, like, hey, I'm just hanging out with my mom, or I'm just hanging out with my dad.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this is fine. But it clearly is a pattern. It doesn't seem like the mother-in-law is into this person at all. I don't know if there's anything that validates her feeling about any of this. Is this the same? Like, another thing you could ask the significant other and be like, if you've been with anybody else that was serious, you know, I don't know, some people don't love talking about that either. Was this also the case?
Yeah.
Because then sometimes
it would be that. Yeah.
Look, I don't know how honest it would be, you know, because what if he's like, yeah, actually, she loved Jessica.
Oh, then, yeah. Then there's
right. Yeah. Then you're getting an answer. You're like, oh, whatever. You're like, her boat was awesome.
Right. But just think about it in another context. Like, imagine if she had, like, a lake house or something, and you're like, yeah, my mom and I are going to the lake house for the weekend. Like, you're not invited. Like, it's just insane. It's an insane move to me. And did she mention it all, like, the dad in the situation? Is he around?
No.
So
didn't mention it.
You kind of mentioned, like, was there some sort of thing that they went through? Maybe, you know, maybe there was some trauma earlier and they're really close because of that. And you kind of have to respect that. We don't know the full details of the situation, but at some point, like, you know, you got to tell this dude, he's got to become his own man. Like, you know, if you want to marry me or be with me or whatever, or use my boat consistently, like, this isn't going to fly.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Next one. Is this stealing? Hope you guys provide some insight in my situation. About 6 foot. All right. 190. Top power lifter in my high school.
Nice.
He attached a bunch of stuff. Nowadays, I just work out enough to maintain a 2-plate bench. Keep the love handles looking more like love knobs. All right. I've gotten a routine that probably should be considered sus. When purchasing tickets to NBA games, I peruse local ticket groups on Facebook until I find desperate game day sellers who will sell their tickets for dirt cheap. I scoop up these cheapies with the intention of just needing to get in the door. Once I arrive at the arena, I hop on the home team's official ticket selling page and look for seats that haven't sold that are way better than the ones I bought. Obviously, knowing if they are still showing for sale, there won't be anyone sitting there. I decide on where I want to sit. Given the options, I make my way to the entrance of that section. They are usually ushers present, but when mass amounts of people are flooding in just before tip-off, they can't check everyone's ticket, so it's easy to sneak on by, even if they even care in the first place. Once in that seat, it's game on. Let's be real. The game is seen completely different 10 rows from the court versus up in the corner nosebleeds. The problem, my girlfriend considers this stealing, whereas I just consider it a loophole or balling on a budget. Here comes the part where I try to justify these tactics. I pad the team's bottom line by paying premium for other things, apparel, concessions, parking, my attention, taxes for their arena. Also, you've done some massive, massive justification for this. Also, part of this behavior stems from being burned by buying full price tickets in the past, only to show up to find out that so-and-so player isn't playing for any number of bullshit reasons. All right.
Thanks, Adam Silver.
Shifting the power back to the people. Between that and the audacity of management to raise prices consistently, regardless of the product put on the court or the field, it doesn't feel wrong to do what I do. Time for the fans to take back some power. Okay, maybe not, but I'm sure you can at least understand where I'm coming from. I would appreciate your viewpoints. Rip me to shreds if you want. I'm still going to listen to the pod. P.S. I attached some of the views I've had. None of these cost more than $25 a ticket with my method. Well, you just exposed your method here a little bit. I'm going to tell you right now, I have no problem with this whatsoever. Okay. Zero. Your girlfriend dumper. No, but just her saying unless this she is has stealing. A boat. Yeah. Unless she's got a boat that you can use with your mom without her. I don't think this is stealing at all. I think it'd almost be elitist to have a problem with this. You have a system. I think the only thing is, as somebody that's been on both sides of this. Okay. I used to move up all the time at Fenway when I didn't have any money, because back then, before Fenway was pink hats and world championships and stupid songs inside the park all the time. I guess they're doing the blur thing now after strikeouts. I don't know exactly when that started, because I don't think I've been to Fenway in a little while.
Wait, but blur song two?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not sure. I'm getting reports from opening day from my buddies that were there, and I'm not super original. I'm not loving it. If that's true, I gotta do some more research. We gotta get IT on that, but. I'm not gonna be a hypocrite here and say, oh, you shouldn't do that, because I don't have a reason to say this is like some philosophical thing. I'm sure there's some people listening being, hey, you buy your ticket, whatever.
No.
There are weird times where you just, I guess I'm sliding another bartender analogy in here, but like there used to be always this dilemma with depending on who you worked with, where you worked at. And yeah, I'm going to hook up my buddies here. I'm going to do a couple, like I wouldn't be like, hey, here's free rounds left and right, but I'll figure out a way to take care of you guys in a couple rounds or whatever. And then there would be this philosophical thing. There's this woman bartender that I work with, and she'd be like, it's not your booze to give away. You don't own the booze. It's not your right. I'm like, yeah, that's technically true, but it's also not really what we do here. Like I can't tell you that you're wrong, but that's not really how anybody looks at this. And we're not at a Chili's. Okay. So, although I don't know what Chili's does. I'm sure there's a couple of people throwing some sidecars down, on the low. A couple Tullamore dudes for the crew in the corner.
Local Bristol Chili's. That place would get weird sometimes.
Yeah, right. Here's some chips. Nobody's looking. So I...
dump a couple Coronas and a margarita call tonight.
Yeah, I don't know. The Coronas may have inventory on. But I don't... I think what you've done is you figured out something here that's a next level, is that you... wait until the last minute. And by the way, the people that are selling their tickets last minute, they already know what agreement they're into. They're on some ticket group going, I'm hoping to get anything to cover anything. And you're probably buying from somebody who's bulked up and bought so many tickets in the first place that they've changed the market. Although the secondary ticket market will argue, at least we provide you a service to be able to get into anything that you ever want to go to. Which is also a weird dynamic of teams being like, wait, we're supposed to let secondary ticket markets just go ahead and sell our product for a greater profit than we're allowed to because of reasons. And then that's why all of these leagues and specific teams partnered with all these secondary ticket merchants anyway. So I don't know that anybody's feeling bad for that part of the transaction. And then once you're in there and you figured out to look at which tickets are still available and they're going to be open, I don't have any problem with this. But she just may be, back to the free drink analogy, she may be just so philosophically opposed to this, she's just not going to see it. We are all on your side. I'd imagine you'd have 90% of the people on your side here. I think the only time that you argue against this is if you're the person that always has those nice seats, and for whatever reason, because you're in the club out back, you know, you never notice, like, in the really good arenas, actually most arenas now at this point, halftime, second half starts, and all the best seats are still empty because they're hanging out in these really cool spots in the arena having drinks, and they're late to get back to there. They're not grinding. They're not taking notes. They're not charting plays, obviously, but they're having drinks, and they're just wandering back in when it's convenient for them. I think when those seats are taken and it's clear that it's like, yeah, I just haven't been back to my seat, and then you show up and the dude gives you a hard time because you weren't in your seat at the right time, that's when you're like, hey, fuck off. Like, you didn't buy the seat. You don't get to just take it because I left and then I was late getting back to it. But that's not even close to what you're doing here. Cerruti.
Is this not the definition of a victimless crime? Like, no one's hurt here. Those tickets weren't going to be sold. So it's not like you're scamming, like, the team. And honestly, like, the team, if you're sitting in, like, the lower bowl, they should probably want that more filled if it's on TV to make it look like it's not empty. Like, I don't think anyone is actually wronged here. So,
yeah, that's like the Yankee Stadium thing with those ridiculous Delta seats, and they're empty all the time because they're so expensive. And then you go, I don't know if they changed that or not. I don't remember from watching the most exciting team in baseball, the Toronto Blue Jays, play at Yankee Stadium to start the season. But go ahead.
I mean, I used to, this was probably 10 years ago now, but when I was in D.C. and they had just opened Nationals Park, I would buy, they'd sell a $5 ticket, it was nosebleeds, and no one would go because they were terrible at that time. And I sat in every different part of that entire ballpark, and honestly, it was, like, pretty awesome. And again, that's what I in my own head, I'm like, I'm not stealing from anyone, I'm not taking anyone's seat, I'm not, like, taking money, I'm still giving money to the team in some way, shape, or form, even though it's $5, and, like, do they not want me to go? Like, I could just not go and spend the $5 and never be at a stadium or never be at a Nats game. So again, this is the definition of a victimless crime. You should not be weird about this. And I think honestly, you have to have a conversation. Your girlfriend seems like too much of a goody two shoes. Like, what? Who? Why is she pro owner? I don't understand, like, what her stance is in this situation. Like, I don't understand, like, why is she like, no, you need to pay the $200 to sit in that actual seat because, you know, the NBA, the profits, but these guys are already making millions of dollars anyway, man. You do you. And honestly, I think you found a pretty cool scheme. Like, that's, I hadn't thought about that, to look at the
what's
the
still available,
bowl, what's right. available. Cause then, you know, and it's all about what the bounce or what the, you know, the attendants do. And if they check you or not, if you have a system in place that allows you to do it, then that's on you, man. That's smart. I respect it.
I'll take it one step further. When I was living in Boston and I would go to Fenway all the time, just because I was like, I'm just going to go to Fenway. I mean, it was a lifelong dream. I'm working in Boston. I'm on the air. I'm like, I can't believe I get to talk about my favorite team ever. And now I can go to Fenway whenever I want. And it was a little less strict then, but it was starting to get to the point where you just couldn't even find a seat in the place. And I would go up to this one section. The usher was just, I mean, legendary older guy. And I'd give him $5. And he would be telling me, like, he would give me, like, hey, that guy's not going to be here tonight. And I would sit in the seat. I did it for like 40 games. Every time I just give him, like, honestly, like, I didn't have any money. I was in. I hated sitting in the press box. I hated it. The press box at Fenway was terrible. And, you know, if you were a guy like me, the lowest of lows, and I'm not really even, you know, I'm not like covering the game. Whatever, you know, I didn't want to sit in the press box anyway. All right. Thanks to Kyle and Steve producing this podcast. We're on your Spotify. Please subscribe. I'll be back on Thursday with Bill on Sundays.